Howdy, regulars. This is Regulars Dispatch number 5. It is May the 5th, 2020. Yesterday, I touched on Julian Simon just a little bit. Sort of the through line was starting with Eddie and Threadgills and the Armadillo on Willie Nelson's birthday, and quickly getting to Doug Somm a few years after that famous Armadillo show, Willie's first in August of 72, and Doug Somm in 1977 is writing a farewell to Austin, and a really great Billy Collins poem next, The Sandhill Cranes of Nebraska, and mentioning how it's all too easy to sit and think we've missed out. We've missed out on our, maybe the potential of our own lives or the potential of the place where we are. It used to be really cool just a few minutes ago, just a year ago, right before we got here. Things are in decline. And that's a sentiment that's all too pervasive in so many arenas. And I think it merits a challenge from each of us. And then if enough people challenge it, then we can eradicate the perception and the reality underlying such conditions. Julian Simon passed away in 1998 at the age of 65. Won't go into his entire biography today or read even much in the way of his original work, but there was this incredible profile that came out in Wired magazine in February of 1997, so just before his death, 1 year before his death, basically, and it was called The Doom Slayer, and the article was written by Ed Regis. Ed, whoever you are, very grateful that you wrote this and got it out there, and I want to read, it's a long, long piece, and I will read big portions of it here. It begins, "This is the litany. Our resources are running out. The air is bad. The water worse. The planet's species are dying off. More exactly, we're killing them at the staggering rate of 100,000 per year, a figure that works out to almost 2,000 species per week, 300 per day, 10 per hour, another dead species every 6 minutes. We're trashing the planet, washing away the topsoil, paving over our farmlands, systematically deforesting our wildernesses, decimating the biota, and ultimately killing ourselves. The world is getting progressively poorer, and it's all because of population, or more precisely, overpopulation. There's a finite store of resources on our pale blue dot, spaceship Earth, our small and fragile, tiny planet, and we're fast approaching its ultimate carrying capacity. The limits to growth are finally upon us, and we're living on borrowed time. The laws of population growth are inexorable. Unless we act decisively, the final result is written in stone: mass poverty, famine, starvation, and death. Time is short, and we have to act now." That is the standard and canonical litany. It's been drilled into our heads so far and so forcefully that to hear it yet once more is, well, almost reassuring. It's comforting, oddly consoling. At least we're face to face with the enemies: consumption, population, mindless growth. And we know the solution: cut back, contract, make do with less. Live simply so that others may simply live. There's just one problem with the litany. Just one slight, little, wee imperfection. Every item in that dim and dreary recitation, each and every last claim, is false. Incorrect. At variance with the truth. Not the way it is, folks. Thus saith the doomslayer, one Julian L. Simon, a neither shy nor retiring nor particularly mild-mannered professor of business administration at a middling Eastern Seaboard State University. Simon paints a somewhat different picture of the human condition, circa 1997. Our species is better off in just about every measurable material way, he says. Just about every important long-run measure of human material welfare shows improvement over the decades and centuries in the United States and the rest of the world. Raw materials, all of them, have become less scarce rather than more. The air in the United States and in other rich countries is irrefutably safer to breathe. Water cleanliness has improved. The environment is increasingly healthy, with every prospect that this trend will continue. Fear is rampant about rapid rates of species extinction, he continues, but the fear has little or no basis. The highest rate of observed extinction, though certainly more have gone extinct unobserved, is one species per year. One species per year. In contrast to the 40,000 per year that some ecologists have been forecasting for the year 2000. The scare that farmlands are blowing and washing away is a fraud upon the public. The aggregate data on the condition of farmland and the rate of erosion do not support the concern about soil erosion. The data suggests that the condition of cropland has been improving rather than worsening. As for global deforestation, the world is not being deforested. It is being reforested in general. Still, there is one resource that the world does not have enough of that's actually getting rarer, according to Julian Simon. That resource? People. People are becoming more scarce, he says, even though there are more of us. Hello? Simon started off as a card-carrying anti-growth, anti-population zealot. He'd been won over by the conventional reasoning. He regarded the central argument as absolutely persuasive. And indeed, if we rehearse it now, it sounds like a faultless proof, clear and compelling, even watertight. The classical case against population growth was expressed in 1798 by Thomas Malthus, the British economist and country parson who wrote in an essay on the principle of population, "Population, when unchecked, increases in a geometrical ratio. Subsistence increases only in an arithmetical ratio. A slight acquaintance with numbers will show the immensity of the first power in comparison of the second. As a point of abstract mathematics, there is no way around the conclusion that a geometric progression, if carried on far enough, will eventually overtake an arithmetic progression, no matter what. If population increases geometrically while subsistence or food increases arithmetically, then sooner or later the population will run out of food. End of story." Or so it would appear, except for the following embarrassing fact. Population has never increased geometrically, says Simon. It increases at all kinds of different rates historically, but however fast it increases, food increases at least as fast, if not faster. In other words, whatever the rate of population growth is, the food supply increases at an even faster rate. These, he says, are the actual and empirical facts of the matter. Information available to any inquirer. Simon first got a taste of those facts while studying the data amassed by the economic demographer Simon Kuznets, winner of the 1971 Nobel Prize in Economics, and by economist Richard Easterlin in the mid-1960s. Kuznets and had followed population growth trends that went back 100 years and compared them against standard of living, while Easterlin had analyzed the same data for selected countries since World War II. The studies showed that while population growth rates varied from country to country and from year to year, there was no general negative correlation with living standards. People did not become poorer as the population expanded. Rather, as their numbers multiplied, they produced what they needed to support themselves, and they prospered. The trends were the same for the food supply. Rising populations did not mean less food, just the opposite. Instead of skyrocketing, as predicted by Malthusian theory, food prices relative to wages had declined historically. In the United States, for example, between 1800 and 1980, the price of wheat plummeted while the population grew from 5 million to 226 million. According to Malthus, all those people should have been long dead, the country reduced to a handful of fur trappers on the brink of starvation. In fact, there was a booming and flourishing populace, one that was better fed, taller, healthier, more disease-free, with far less infant mortality and longer life expectancy than ever before in human history. Obesity, not starvation, was the major American food problem in 1980. Those were the facts. I'm skipping several pages of the article. I like this little bit about very young Julian Simon. Simon acquired his habit of looking up the facts in early childhood at the dinner table of the family home in Newark, New Jersey. He'd be in some argument with his father over the benefit of exercise, the price of butter, or the health value of air conditioning. And whether from ignorance, pigheadedness, or general perversity, his father would always take some outlandish, off-the-wall viewpoint, such as, "The price of butter is 8 cents a pound." Julian, "No, it's not. It's 80 cents a pound. It's in the newspaper. Take a look." Father, "I don't have to look. I know it's 8 cents a pound." Julian, "Do you want to bet?" "I'll bet you it's not 8 cents a pound." His father would never take the bet, but Julian would go to the library anyway, look up things in books, and come back with reams of facts and data. His father, however, couldn't care less. "I clearly didn't like my father," says Simon. "It's an attitude that drives him crazy to this day. People who know in advance what the truth is, who don't need to avail themselves of any facts." But Simon loves facts and figures. He loves tables, charts, graphs, information arranged in rows and columns, tabulations, the slopes of curves, diagrams, pie charts, histograms. He's a regular Mr. Data. And by the way, if in your mind, this is just me talking, if in your mind right now you're picturing one particular cable news network and not the others, thinking the people that listen to that cable news network are who he's talking about, and he's not talking about you or the cable news network that you watch, I have to tell you, I'm not sure I agree with you. I think he's talking about all of us, every single one of us, and frankly, the idea of television news in general. One of these days, I'll pick up a whole bunch of Edward Tufte stuff, I sure hope, and I love his ideas like the only way to see it is to see it. Such a wonderful little turn of phrase. Also his idea that that kind of medium is offers no information density at all. That you can spend 2 hours of your life in front of that kind of stuff and come away not having any real knowledge whatsoever. Another little interesting factoid returning to the Julian Simon thread is he deserves credit for airlines paying us to wait for the next flight when they oversell a flight. The article says, and the article tells the story of his introducing the idea, says, then in 1966 or so, he had his big idea about how to solve the airline booking problem. Anticipating no-shows, airlines routinely oversold flights. The idea was laughed at, mocked, and ridiculed as unrealistic and unworkable. That's his idea, that what you should do is just announce and keep upping the offer until you have enough people who will accept compensation to skip the flight. 11 years later, in 1977, Simon hadn't given up on the scheme. He published it in the Wall Street Journal in an op-ed piece titled, "Wherein the Author Offers a Modest Proposal." And lo and behold, a year after that, when economist Alfred Kahn headed up the Civil Aeronautics Board, Simon's proposal was put into practice. It was a raging success from the start, remains so to this day, and anyone who's ever voluntarily offloaded themselves from a plane for cash or free miles owes a nod of thanks to Julian Simon. Still, that was a mere flash in the pan, and Simon's overall impact on the world at large was rather less massive than he desired. He was not making a name for himself, nor setting the world on fire. But there were those who were. Paul Ehrlich, for example. Ehrlich, a Stanford University entomologist who as a youth had seen his best butterfly hunting grounds churned under the real estate developer's plow, wrote the runaway bestseller, The Population Bomb. Published in 1968, the book was solidly Malthusian. "The battle to feed all of humanity is over," it began. In the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of millions of people will starve to death in spite of any crash programs embarked upon now. at this late date, nothing can prevent a substantial increase in the world death rate, although many lives could be saved through dramatic programs to stretch the carrying capacity of the earth by increasing food production and providing for more equitable distribution of whatever food is available. But these programs will only provide a stay of execution unless they are accompanied by determined and successful efforts at population control. And so on. The complete and authoritative litany for the next 200 pages. This late-breaking Malthusian outburst, strangely enough, did set the world on fire. The book sold 3 million copies, became the best-selling environmental tract of all time, and got the author on The Tonight Show. At home in Illinois, Simon watched Ehrlich on The Johnny Carson Show and went bananas. In fact, more bananas than he'd ever gone before in his life. Simon had, by that time, decided that the Malthusian stuff was the purest mythology, an invention out of whole cloth, a theory that was entirely controverted by every available empirical fact. And here was Paul Ehrlich on TV, spreading his stardust all over the place and holding Johnny Carson in some kind of mystic thrall. "It absolutely drove me out of my skull," he recalls. Here was a guy reaching a vast audience, leading this juggernaut of environmentalist hysteria, and I felt utterly helpless. What could I do? Go talk to five people? As bad an experience as that was, matters got immediately worse. The next year, 1969, Ehrlich published an article called "Eco-Catastrophe" in Ramparts. Most of the people who are going to die in the greatest cataclysm in the history of man have already been born, it said. By that time, 1975, some experts feel that food shortages will have escalated the present level of world hunger and starvation into famines of unbelievable proportions. Then in 1964, Ehrlich and his wife, Ann Ehrlich, also a Stanford biologist, published a new book, The End of Affluence, in which they warned of a nutritional disaster that seems likely to overtake humanity in the 1970s, or at the latest, the 1980s, due to a combination of ignorance, greed, and callousness. A situation has been created that could lead to a billion or more people starving to death. Before 1985, mankind will enter a genuine age of scarcity, in which the accessible supplies of many key minerals will be nearing depletion. Julian Simon read this stuff, which he viewed as unalloyed and total nonsense. He brooded and fumed and stewed in his juices. He experienced what might be called a personal lull. And then finally, in 1980, he emerged from the cocoon. He'd gone into it as a humble professor of marketing and a passive spectator of global death sentence forecasts, but now suddenly he broke out into the light of day. He sprang forth onto the world stage. He started swinging his diamond-tipped sword as the doomslayer. The rebirth occurred in the pages of Science in an article titled "Resources, Population, Environment, An Oversupply of False Bad News." It led with a summary that became a manifesto. False bad news about population growth, natural resources, and the environment is published widely in the face of contrary evidence. For example, the world supply of arable land has actually been increasing. The scarcity of natural resources, including food and energy, has been decreasing, and basic measures of U.S. environmental quality show positive trends. The aggregate data show no long-run negative effect of population growth upon standard of living. Models that embody forces omitted in the past, especially the influence of population size upon productivity increase, suggest a long-run positive effect of additional people. Written in the form of statement followed by fact, every reigning doomsday dragon was neatly slashed in half. The severed beasts left flapping around on the ground like fish. And then it ticks off the food situation, urban sprawl, and several other issues. Letters to the editor poured into Science in an unseemly rush. A few of them expressed partial agreement, but the majority were heavily critical. Many of them repeated statutory items of the litany. Human beings, like any other species, have the biological capacity to overrun the carrying capacity of their habitat, and there were even some feeble attempts at humor in extrapolating from past trends, said one writer. Simon is like the person who leaped from a tall building, and on being asked how things were going as he passed the 20th floor, replied, "Fine so far." Simon's response, "I think the better story is about somebody who has a rope lifeline and falls off the 15th floor. Somewhere about 30 feet above the ground, she lets go of the rope. You ask her, 'Why'd you let go of the rope?' And she answers, 'It was going to break anyway.' That's how many activists would like us to behave." Ann and Paul Ehrlich, along with two energy and natural resource experts, John Holdren and John Hart, wrote their own letter to the editor. After charging Simon with various errors about the economics of scarcity, they went on to make some new doomsday predictions. If deforestation for agriculture proceeds on a large enough scale, the resulting pulse of carbon dioxide may combine with that from increasing fossil fuel combustion to alter global climate in a way that undermines food production to an unprecedented degree. They also corrected one of Simon's data points having to do with electricity, which Simon claimed had gotten cheaper. The fact is, they said, that real electricity prices bottomed in 1971 and were already up 18% from that low point in 1972. An 18% increase when Simon said there'd been a decline. "I was taken aback," said Simon in his published reply. Holdren and Hart are energy scholars. I checked figure one and other sources but could see no sign of their 18%. So he placed a phone call to the co-author of the report cited by Holdren, Hart, and the Ehrlichs. He too was puzzled. Upon investigation, the 1971 number, 80.2, proved to be a typographical error and should have been 93.3. So much for Holdren et al.'s fact. This leads to a famous wager, which I'll come to at a later date. Go read the story yourself if you want, between Julian Simon and Paul Ehrlich. Suffice it to say that Julian Simon won the bets, was proved right. Nonetheless, Paul Ehrlich received a MacArthur Foundation Genius Award in 1990, and Julian Simon jokes that he wouldn't even get a McDonald's award. I do also want to touch on this notion of species destruction. It's quite fascinating. Let me find it here. He wrote a big book. The Ultimate Resource 2 is fantastic. I recommend the read. But he wrote a book called The State of Humanity, and just produced all this information, all these tables, tons and tons of data, trying to buttress his conceptual view and various positions with actual information, and not just sort of scandalous and attention-raising proclamations about the future. So here's one. And I also think this is interesting. And I have to say, going in, this really reminds me, too, of all the furor around Thomas Piketty in the book Capital, and all this information around income inequality. And I would just ask you, as we get into this, to think about, have you read the book? Have you read any critiques of the book? Do you accept it as gospel truth? That what do you even think Piketty's claims are, and what sport do you think he has in those claims? We'll come back to these later. For now, Julian Simon on species annihilation is pretty interesting, and I would say mainly it's not interesting. It's interesting enough around the notion of species, but to me it's even more fascinating about the process. The process itself, the process of discovery, not just dispute, discovery, argument as a process of mutual discovery, and really understanding a terrain, understanding where the numbers come from, understanding the methodology behind it, and preserving in your mind the idea of scientific inquiry, which is skeptical by nature. It's not hubristic. It's not overly exclamatory. It's interrogatory. And you're trying, I suppose, I'm no scientist, by the way, but you're trying to disprove something. You don't prove things. We're going to also get into some of the writing, thinking, and speeches from Michael Crichton in the coming days, and just keep weaving all this stuff together because it's quite fascinating. Some of Simon's other claims, however, are so far from received opinion as to be hard to take seriously. His view on species loss, for example, regarding which he asserts that the highest rate of observed extinctions is one species per year. That was hard to accept. Harvard biologist Edward O. Wilson, the guru of global species extinction, said in 1991, "Believe me, species become extinct. We're easily eliminating 100,000 a year." A year later, in his 1992 book, The Diversity of Life, he had modified that figure somewhat, saying, "The number of species doomed each year is 27,000. Apparently, these numbers were a tiny bit slippery. Still, both of them were a far cry from Simon's one species per year. Simon, on the other hand, pointed out that the higher estimates did not come from observation. They came from theory, specifically from Wilson's own theory of island biogeography, which correlates species extinction with tropical forest destruction. The theory's species area equation, supposedly, predicts that for each additional unit of forest destroyed, so many more species die out. This was another mathematical argument reminiscent of the one made long ago by Malthus, and it was exactly the type of neat mathematical certainty that Julian Simon took so much joy in shooting big holes through, which is what he proceeded to do now. The problem with the theory, he wrote in a paper on species loss with Aaron Wildalfsky, is that it is not borne out by the empirical facts. The only empirical observation we have found is by Lugo for Puerto Rico, where human activity reduced the area of primary forests by 99%. This massive forest conversion did not lead to a correspondingly massive species extinction. Simon quoted Lugo to the effect that the more land birds have been present on the island in the 1980s, 97 species, than were present in pre-Columbian times, 60 species. Say again, the forest was 99% demolished and the number of bird species actually rose. Even for me, this was too much. The International Institute of Tropical Forestry, part of the U.S. Forest Service, is located in an overgrown stone building in San Juan's Botanical Gardens. Ariel E. Lugo, a slim, gray-bearded man in a silver-green Forest Service uniform, is director. He's also a world-class expert on tropical forests and species extinction. A native of Puerto Rico, Lugo was educated in San Juan, threw his master's degree, came to the mainland, got a PhD in plant ecology from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, then taught botany for 10 years at the University of Florida. He spent 2 years at the Puerto Rico Department of Natural Resources and 2 more years on Jimmy Carter's Council on Environmental Quality in Washington, D.C. Finally, he went back to San Juan as director of the Institute, a position he's held for the last 17 years. "I see myself as in the middle of the road," he says. "On the right of me is Julian Simon, who sees nothing wrong. You know, we're doing just fine. I don't want to put me at that extreme." Still, Lugo is not what could be called a major supporter of Wilson's theory of island biogeography or of the species area equation that forms its mathematical centerpiece. The equation is simply enough, S equals CAZ, where S is the number of species, A is the area, and C and Z are constants for the type of species in question, its location, and other factors. The apparent certainty it embodies, however, is an illusion, according to Lugo. The first uncertainty is that we don't know how many species there are. The margin of error is enormous. I'm sorry, does this remind you of present conditions at all? It does me. I have to just interject and say that this is This is the kind of stuff I want to talk about personally in these dispatches, and then over time with interviews. I can't wait to grab people's biographies and character sketches, who they are and their stories, everybody's stories, and entrepreneurship and the web and all kinds of great stuff. But man, this is fascinating. So here's Lugo again. The first uncertainty is that we don't know how many species there are. The margin of error is enormous. Depending on who you talk to, there is anywhere between 5 million and 100 million species. But science has described only 1 million species. How can you predict how many species are lost if you don't know how many species you're dealing with? The second problem is that the equation was never intended to describe extinctions to begin with. It was a device for explaining the number of species on islands, he says. Generally, the bigger the island, the more species it has, other things being equal. But even if cutting down an island's forest causes species to leave the area, that's not the same thing as making those species extinct. The presence or absence of a species in a particular area is one thing, whereas wiping out the genome of that species is another thing altogether. Wiping out the seed, wiping out the mechanisms for hibernation, wiping out its dispersal, wiping out the management of the species, that's a completely different biology. And what is the relationship between deforestation and species loss to begin with? He asks. Do we understand that? Do we know that when you deforest an acre, you lose X proportion of species to extinction? Well, I'm afraid that nobody knows that. There is not one study that can claim to have understood the relationship between deforestation and species loss to extinction. And so, if you're an objective scientist, he says, you cannot put a number to the rate of species lost. But I believe we're exaggerating the numbers. What's unstated in all this is that when you deforest, you go to zero, that you go to pavement. That's how I put it, that you go to pavement. That is why people get mad at me, because at this point in my talks, I show a slide of pavement, but the pavement has weeds growing through it. I can take you to places of abandoned roads in the rainforest that have trees growing out of them. Trees sprouting from the asphalt, birds perching on the branches, insects crawling, worms boring, bees buzzing, lizards walking, moss growing on the tree trunk. Look at the example of Puerto Rico, Lugo says. This island has a documented deforestation rate of 90%, and it has a documented loss of primary forest of 97 to 98%. So here's an island that has lost, here's an island that has lost in the past, in the recent past, up to the 50s. I was already born when the island was at the peak of deforestation. It's lost almost all of its forest. The first surprise is that there are more bird species here now than ever, in part due to the invasion of non-indigenous species. The second surprise is that much of the forest has grown back. On Lugo's conference table is a book open to two photographs. Now, where I'm going to send you today, he says, is here. He points to a road that winds through the western fringe of El Yunque, the Caribbean National Forest, the only tropical rainforest in the U.S., National Forest System. Picture one, an aerial photograph taken in 1951, shows the area on the west side of the road, clear cut, mowed down, absolutely denuded of trees. It looks like stumps and dead grass. The east side of the road, by contrast, is deep, dark, and flush with vegetation, an untouched virgin rainforest. Picture two shows the same area 13 years later. From the aerial photograph, both sides of the road are identical. You can see that it recovers, said Lugo. So you take your car and you ride through these forests and you tell me. Puerto Rico, Route 186, is not far away, about 30 miles by traffic jam. The road is paved but unmarked, slightly more than a lane wide, just enough space for two cars to pass without the sound of impact. You drive toward the mountains, white clouds bunched above, isolated raindrops splattering the windshield. And in 5 or 6 minutes, there's tropical forests on both sides. Tall ferns, flame trees, mahogany trees, humongous green leafy plants, plus massive clumps of bamboo, stalks that tower 20 or 30 feet overhead. Julian Simon, the facts are fundamental. Garrett Hardin, the facts are not fundamental, the theory is fundamental. From a 1982 debate with UC Santa Barbara biologist, the doomsayer debate, Simon thinks is an opposition between fact and bad theory, a case of empirical reality versus abstract principles that purport to define the way things work but don't. It's the difference, he says, between a speculative analysis of what must happen versus my empirical analysis of what has happened over the long sweep of history. The paradox is that those abstract principles and speculative analyses seem so very logical and believable, whereas the facts themselves, the story of what has happened, appear wholly illogical and impossible to explain. After all, people are fruitful, and they multiply. But the stores of raw materials in the Earth's crust certainly don't. So how can it be possible that as the world's population doubles, the price of raw materials is cut in half? It makes no sense. Yet, it has happened. So there must be an explanation, and there is. Resources, for the most part, don't grow on trees. People produce them. They create them. Whether it be food, factories, machines, new technologies, or stockpiles of mined, refined, and purified raw materials. Resources come out of people's minds more than out of the ground or air, says Simon. Minds matter economically as much or more than hands or mouths. Human beings create more than they use on average. It had to be so, or we would be an extinct species. The defect of the Malthusian models, superficially plausible but invariably wrong, is that they leave the human mind out of the equation. These models simply do not comprehend key elements of people, the imaginative and creative. As for the future, this is my long-run forecast in brief, says Simon. The material conditions of life will continue to get better for most people in most countries, most of the time, indefinitely. Within a century or two, all nations and most of humanity will be at or above today's Western living standards. I also speculate, however, that many people will continue to think and say that the conditions of life are getting worse. But you don't have to be one of those people, one of those forever glum and gloomy gusses. All you've got to do is keep your mind on the facts. The world is not coming to an end. Things are not running out. Time is not short. So smile. Shout. Enjoy the afternoon. That is a great profile, and I only read maybe, I don't even know, a quarter of it. Pretty wonderful. I'm not even trying to make particular conclusions about things like species, deforestation, etc. But I do find massively, massively compelling the assertion that the bad news prognosticators are listened to, and when they are wrong, they simply just need to double down. Here's another paragraph from the article, one more. He always found it somewhat peculiar that neither the science piece nor his public wager with Ehrlich, which he won, nor anything else that he did, said, or wrote seemed to make much of a dent on the world at large. For some reason, he could never comprehend. People were inclined to believe the very worst about anything and everything. They were immune to contrary evidence, just as if they'd been medically vaccinated against the force of fact. Furthermore, there seemed to be a bizarre reverse Cassandra effect operating in the universe. Whereas the mythical Cassandra spoke the awful truth and was not believed, these days, experts spoke awful falsehoods, and they were believed. Repeatedly being wrong actually seemed to be an advantage, conferring some sort of puzzling magic glow upon the speaker. This was written in 97. It's obviously, 23 years later. We're in the same position or worse, as far as I can tell. Continuing to believe bad news. And I would also actually say just continuing to ignore facts. Again, if you're picturing in your mind the, quote, other side, the people who watch the other cable news network, they are the ones who don't ignore facts. And your side is armed with facts. I would ask you to reconsider. One other little story for today, and then I'm going to call it. Yesterday, this was 3 minutes long. Today, this is going long. I am often reminded, I've never read the book, The Right Stuff, by Thomas Wolfe. I've seen the movie several times, love the movie. It's the story, they start it with Chuck Yeager and they cover the first astronauts in the space program, the United States space program. They have to figure out who has the right stuff, as it were, who should be the astronauts who get to go to space. And so they pull in exceptional pilots, and they subject them to a battery of tests, physical, psychological, all manner of stuff, selection course to see who deserves to get to represent humanity and go into space, or at least represent the United States. And there's this wonderful scene. I think it's on YouTube. I'll put it in the notes for this. You can look it up. Makes me want to go watch the whole movie again. It's fantastic. When they've gathered all these exceptional pilots together, they're competitive people. One of the tests is they have them sit in two rows facing each other, maybe 6x6 or 4x4. And there's this contraption in front of them that is suspending. It's like water and some sort of, I don't know if it's oxygen or what gas is running through these tubes. And there's sort of a, for lack of a better term, like a jug in front of them. And this tube shoots out to each participant. And your job is to blow into the tube just hard enough. It looks like it must have been pretty hard, exerting pressure from your lungs, which raises a ping pong ball in a tube that runs vertically right in front of you. And there's two lines drawn on this tube. So you have to exert enough air pressure to raise that ping pong ball in the tube and hold it between those two lines for as long as you can. And therein is the competition. And I forget what the record is. It's like, I can't even remember the record. I should have looked at it before thinking about this. It's 60 seconds or whatever it might be, 93 seconds. I can't remember what it is. But the administrator of the experiment tells them what the record is, and they square off against each other. They start the stopwatches, and they're all just sort of sitting there at first pretty casually. You're just kind of not just holding your breath. You're having to expel air or pressure from your lungs. But then they start tapping out over time, tapping out. And I forget the astronaut played by a very young Dennis Quaid, but he sees the record time go by on the clock and he stops and celebrates. But then only then does he look down the table, and John Glenn and played by Ed Harris and whoever's sitting across from John Glenn are just sitting there calmly, still trucking, going well past the record time. And then they both tap out. But that little device of your job is to steel yourself and keep this ping pong ball aloft for as long as you can. I think about that often whenever we're talking about any topic at all. Transit in Austin, rail versus no rail, global warming, tax policy, anything at all, the 2008 financial crisis and what should have been done after it. And I think about that selection course, but the way I apply it is to imagine that what if my job was to speak on this topic, and I may have been blustering passionately about it for 15 minutes, but then what if I could only speak while presenting clear, corroborating evidence, facts? Almost to take any subject to say, oh, great, so you've been watching the news about this. Tell me everything I need to know about it, speaking only in facts. And I think we'd all be shocked at how quickly we would tap out of that competition, especially relative to how much time we spend watching the news, reading the news, thumbing through the news, so-called. I'm just not sure that it's a very effective conveyor of information or knowledge, understanding, or empathy at all. I'm not sure what to do about it yet. So I'm simply ruminating on the problem side of the coin, not the solution yet. But it's on my mind. And the reason I wanted to read Julian Simon, he's a personal hero of mine, but I do see it of a piece with what we've covered so far. Even the part starting with Eddie Wilson and Willie Nelson and the armadillo in 1972, this idea that, oh, woe is us, we've missed out on Austin. Billy Collins, you know, oh, if only you'd been here a few weeks ago when the Sandhill Cranes were here, the azaleas were blooming. Julian Simon, oh, if only we were here before, and now in the very near future, we're all going to starve to death because there's simply too many of us. I really appreciate the idea that the most important resource is our creativity and imagination. And so I appreciate your being here, and I appreciate your contributions, your creativity and imagination. I want you to come along for the ride, and let us, the regulars, know how we can help you do your thing, because it's simply a large sea of such individuals who are driving the world. Thanks.